Hello, I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. You're about to hear a special pilot of Radio Aloud, a library of the airwaves, recorded in 2006 with Alfred Molina as guest host. The program was produced by Johanna Cooper and myself, never broadcast, and is made available for your listening pleasure as a tribute to Johanna, a great spirit and a great friend of Aloud, who passed away on July 10th of 2008.
From the Los Angeles Central Library, this is Radio Aloud. I'm Alfred Molina. In this program, you'll hear from the creative force behind the groundbreaking television series 6 Feet Under.
I've got what you undertakers seem always to know. Once you put a dead guy in the room, you can talk about anything, you know.
And from the Aloud at Central Library archive, a memorable afternoon with the late Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, August Wilson.
I looked up one day and death was marching straight at me, like soldiers on parade. The army of death marching straight at me.
Finally, poet W.S. Merwin, 2005 National Book Award winner, explores the primal source of poetry.
Poetry exists to say what words can't say, and one turns to poetry for those things.
Welcome to Radio Aloud. I'm Alfred Molina. Every week, leading figures in the world of literature, art, and ideas speak to a live audience as part of the award-winning Aloud at Central Library Speakers series. Radio Aloud brings you the best of these encounters, a chance to be a part of what goes on between the lines and behind the scenes of fiction and non-fiction, poetry, film, and plays. Radio Aloud amplifies the connection between the written word and the world around us. Alan Ball, who won an Academy Award for his film American Beauty, was the creator and executive producer of 6 Feet Under, HBO's critically acclaimed drama series about a family-run funeral home in Los Angeles. Thomas Lynch, a poet and essayist, has been the funeral director in the town of Milford, Michigan for the past 30 years. His book, The Undertaking, Studies from the Dismal Trade, won an American Book Award and was a finalist for the National Book Award. Ball and Lynch have long admired each other's work, but they had never met until we invited them to share the stage at Central Library for a program titled When You Put a Dead Guy in the Room, You Can Talk About Anything.
We were just saying back in the green room how we sort of feel like we've known each other for a while, because we've exchanged emails and we spoke, and I certainly feel like I've been tremendously influenced by Thomas's work.
Alan Ball, creator of 6 Feet Under.
I just got back from Georgia. My mom passed away about 6 weeks ago, and she had left very specific instructions. She wanted a very fast funeral, the cheapest casket, and only the immediate family there. But she said, if you want to do something later that involves everybody, and that will help people then feel free to. So we just had a really, really lovely, moving, hilarious, weird gathering of my family. And at the time, I was rereading Thomas's book, both his first two books while I was down there, and it was really kind of a wonderful experience.
Early on, we had a little email correspondence, and I think it was between the first and the second season when Alan wrote to me saying that things were getting easier in terms of production.
And Thomas Lynch, poet and funeral director.
In the context of the note, he said, I've got what you undertakers seem always to know. Once you put a dead guy in the room, you can talk about anything, you know. And it sounded very sensible, you know. And it was sort of the formula for, you know, what funeral directors have been doing for a long time, putting a dead guy in the room and seeing what happens. But to the extent that it ups the emotional ante, there's so many possibilities, some of them very good, some of them, you know, very dangerous, but...
What are the consequences of not having a funeral and not having the dead guy in the room?
You know, it's... we go to these events you know, where the talk is uplifting, the music is life-affirming, the finger food is always well-chosen, and someone can be counted on to declare closure, usually just before the Merlot runs out, and we come away from these saying, is there something missing? And usually what's missing is like what you'd notice missing if you went to a baptism without the baby there, or a wedding without the bride and groom. You'd say, gee, that was really nice, but was there something missing? So to me, the dead guy in the room represents sort of the essential manifest. Mm. And mm. what was so powerful about Alan's work when I first beheld it, I mean, and we were all sort of, as you might imagine, the Undertakerly types were on pins and needles waiting for this this to happen. And I can remember very clearly, it was like, well, when they're really paying you an awful lot of money, you would call it a paradigm shift, you know. But it was like, in my life, it was, for the first time in my adult life, the conversation switched from how much to how come, or what are we going to spend to what are we going to do about this notion that people die. So this was from the pilot show, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. This was the first Nathaniel Sr. has been killed by a bus on Christmas Eve.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. The Lord bless him and keep him. The Lord make his face to shine upon him and be gracious unto him. The Lord lift up his countenance upon him and give him peace.
No! I refuse to sanitize this anymore. Huh? What is this hermetically sealed box, this phony astroturf around the grave? Jesus, David, it's like surgery. Clean, antiseptic, business. He was our father.
Please don't do this.
You can pump him full of chemicals, you can put makeup on him, and you can prop him up for a nap in the slumber room, but the fact remains, David, that the only father we're ever gonna have is gone.
Forever. And that sucks, but it's a part of life, and you can't really accept it without getting your hands dirty.
Amen.
I just think it's so remarkable that, you know, right out of the gate, you're into this deep end of the pool where people are talking about the difference between what's virtual and what's authentic. And this is a theme that runs all the way through the series, this constant testing of the waters for what is real. And
well, it's a throwback to what you write about in your first book about how the dead used to be at home. You know, people would die at home. People would grow old and die at home. And then they would be laid out in the home. And it was something that happened, and you saw it. And there was it was a communal experience with your family. And then somehow it became part of the service economy. And I know that, you know, when I was 13 years old, my sister was killed in a car accident. We were very close. And then she just disappeared. And all of a sudden I went to a funeral home and saw her in a coffin. But it was so bizarre to me. And it was a really, it was an experience that really shaped me. So that when Carolyn Strauss came to me from HBO and said, I want to do a show about a family that runs a funeral home, I just thought, oh, that's great. And she said, well, you got to read this book, The American Way of Death, Revisited, because it was the reissue by Jessica Mitford, which is the book that sparked her. And I read it, and I thought, well, this isn't it. This isn't what the show should be. And then I read Thomas's work, and it was the combination of just unsentimental looking into the face of death and seeing the horror and the beauty of it at the same time, and how it connects those of us who are left behind. And that's when I got a sense of what the show could be. And it is a thing that we all live with, that our culture does everything it can to pretend like it doesn't exist, that we can live forever, that all the right products and all the right things will make us happy but what it does is it doesn't connect us to the earth. It doesn't connect us to our own mortality. And I believe that until you fundamentally accept the truth of your own mortality, you never really fully start to live.
It is like punctuation, isn't it?
You know?
It's like you don't get the meaning of a sentence until you know whether it's like an exclamation point or a question mark. Or
exactly.
What do they call those dots at the end? But anyway, it is punctuation for...
Yeah.
6 Feet Under also kind of really pointed the way. I mean, it was...
Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud.
My parents died in 1990, and I remember it was sudden with my father and going to the mortuary and asking... I was telling Thomas this, asking if I could sit with my dad, you know, and it was considered a very strange request, even though I later found out that it is the Jewish custom to sit with the dead, you know, but somehow, and then it turned out by having a Jewish burial, we were actually paying someone who was going to come in the night and sit with the dead. And I thought, well, why aren't we doing that?
Yeah, you know,
why weren't we offered that option? But I think at the time it would have been considered strange, you know, and I think my family would have considered it strange because we are of that culture that doesn't, right. You know, doesn't look at that.
There's a lot in the pilot that I took straight from my own life. When my sister died, my mom was standing at the open casket and looking at her, and she just broke down weeping, and someone appeared and shepherded her off behind a curtain.
And the
subtext was, well, nobody really wants to see this. Nobody should see this. It's too personal. And you're like, well, isn't this the whole point of this ritual, to get together so we can share these feelings and not be afraid of them and not be ashamed of them? And then years later, I went to Europe and I saw these Sicilian women on the coast of Sicily. And on the boat I was on, they brought a casket and they just flung themselves on it and were banging and pulling their hair out. And it was certainly more colorful. And for me, I felt like, wow, I wish I had been able to do that. But in my culture and in family, it just wasn't an option.
Thomas, did you have some revelation in some other culture in terms of other possibilities or other ways?
I mean, the Irish have always, you know, done a lot of this around drink so that they are either allowed to cry or kept from it. You know, it can be used either way. But they do believe in... Once you put a dead guy in the room, you can talk about it. They do believe that you have to have, that your obligation is to get the dead where they need to go, and you have to accompany them. And really, we are the first. I mean, depending on what channel you're watching, the species has been doing this for about 40,000 years. Before they had, like, alphabets or farming, they were, you know, consigning their dead to some oblivion and looking into that void and asking what turn out to be kind of signature questions for the species, you know. Is that all there is? Why does it smell? Can this happen to me? What comes next? And we've been doing this in the context of putting the dead either into the fire or the tree or the pit or the cave or the sea. And it's only been the past 40 or 50 years that we've had, like, this is such an American word, options in this, you know, where you can get, you know, where you can get someone like me on the phone in the middle of the night, and as long as you have a gold card, you know, and a security code, we can downsize or disappear the dead. I was at Rosa Parks' funeral last month, and I was, very fortunate to be there because I was a friend of O'Neill Swanson, who was her funeral director in Detroit, and he asked me to come down to the Museum of African American History, where she was laid out at 6 a.m. So we went down there, and she was moved to the Greater Grace Temple. And then from the Greater Grace Temple, after about, I'd say, 8 hours of politicians and preachers holding forth, and all of it brilliant, I must say, to 5,000 of us. And then they processed her to Woodlawn Cemetery. It was dark. And on the way, there were people holding, you know, candles out and balloons. There were 50,000 people between and along that 10-mile route. And I thought, this is it. We process mortality by processing our dead from one station to the other. And that presence is very powerful. And the rest is all accessory. You know, whether or not you're embalmed or whether or not you're in a box or whether or not you do it with a salt shaker or a fistful, that's accessory. Those are fashion statements. The fundamental obligation of the living to tend to their dead seems to me like humanity 101.
You're listening to Radio Aloud, a presentation of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Read this entire chapter. I love this chapter.
This I was flying out here some years ago and came over the desert right at the edge of the San Bernardino Mountains and saw this little patch of organized green from 30,000 feet. And I said, well, that must be a cemetery. And then I said, well, or it could be a golf course. And then I remember thinking to myself, well, this is California. It could be both. And so I wrote this piece called The Golfatorium, and I'm always amazed that this is a little piece that turns up in it. A man that I work with named Wesley Rice once spent all of one day and all night carefully piecing together the parts of a girl's cranium. She'd been murdered by a madman with a baseball bat after he'd abducted and raped her. The morning of the day it all happened, she'd left for school, dressed for picture day, a schoolgirl dressed to the nines, waving at her mother, ready for the photographer. The picture was never taken. She was abducted from the bus stop and found a day later in a stand of trees just off the road, a township south of here. After he'd raped her and strangled her and stabbed her, he beat her head with a baseball bat, which was found beside the child's body. The details were reported dispassionately in the local media, along with the speculations as to which of the wounds was the fatal one, the choking, the knife, or the baseball bat. No doubt these speculations were the focus of the double post-mortem the medical examiner performed on her body before signing the death certificate, multiple injuries. Most embalmers faced with what Wesley Rice was faced with after he'd opened the pouch from the morgue would have simply said, closed casket, treated the remains enough to control the odor, zipped the pouch, and gone home for cocktails. It would have been easier. The pay was the same. Instead, he started working. 18 hours later, the girl's mother, who had pleaded to see her, saw her. She was dead, to be sure, and damaged, but her face was hers again, not the madman's version. The hair was hers, not his. The body was hers, not his. Wesley Rice had not raised her from the dead nor hidden the hard facts, but he had retrieved her death from the one who had killed her. He'd closed her eyes and mouth. He'd washed her wounds, sutured her lacerations, pieced her beaten skull together, stitched the incisions from the autopsy, cleaned the dirt from under her fingernails, scrubbed the fingerprint ink from her fingertips, washed her hair, dressed her in jeans and a blue turtleneck, and laid her in a casket beside which her mother stood for 2 days and sobbed as if something had been pulled from her by force. It was the same when her pastor stood with her and told her, God weeps with you, and the same when they buried the body in the ground. It was then and always will be awful, horrible, unappeasably sad. But the outrage, the horror, the heartbreak belonged not to the murderer or to the media or to the morgue, each of whom had staked their claims to it. It belonged to the girl and to her mother. Wesley had given them the body back. Barbaric is what some people call this fussing over a dead body. I say the monster with a baseball bat was barbaric. What Wesley Rice did was a kindness. And to the extent that it is easier to grieve the loss that we see than the one we imagine or read about in papers or hear of on the evening news, it was what we undertakers call a good funeral. It served the living by caring for the dead. So that's a little oxymoron. Thank you.
Poet and undertaker Thomas Lynch.
That little oxymoron about a good funeral always struck me as, but so much of what goes on 6 Feet Under is trying to sort of figure out what works.
But there are good funerals.
Yeah,
and I think,
yeah.
You know, a good funeral is so helpful. Yeah. I just came from a good funeral.
Writer, director, Alan Ball.
My brother insisted on calling it a celebration of life. which sort of made me think it was a billboard for Forest Lawn. But it was good. It was very good.
You told stories?
Oh, yeah. We found some great dirt out about my mom.
Did you see people that you hadn't seen?
I did see people I hadn't seen in a really long time, some of whom I didn't really want to see, but, you know.
Well, that celebration of life is, I mean, we do approve the good laugh better than the good cry, don't we?
Yeah. You know?
But it is sort of, the whole register's open, you know. As you say, once you put a dead guy in there, the whole register is open. And I think
in a way we go through life with this sort of notion, you know, death is like the pink elephant. You know, it's just sort of like, well, today I'm not going to think about it. And so much of our life has evolved so that we don't have to think about it. We don't have to go out and kill the chicken so we can eat. You know, we don't have to slaughter the pig so we can have bacon in the morning. We don't have to bury half of our children because they don't live past 12.
Yeah.
You know, and so we're sort of insulated from it, and it's there in any case. And when you put a dead guy in the room, it sort of reminds you that it's there.
I mean, it's so very basic human.
Yeah.
Stuff. Let's pause at this point, unless you have another question for each other, and open it up to the audience.
Let's open up.
I was recently at a dinner with three octogenarians, and somehow the topic of a cousin who had recently died came up, and she had left the arrangements to her children, and they decided to cremate her, and these three cousins were outraged that the children decided to cremate. And then Uncle Nino said that he had heard that oftentimes in cremation there are, you know, six or seven bodies done at the same time, and the ashes aren't necessarily yours. And so though he wanted to be cremated, he was worried about the ashes not being his. And it occurred to me that why does it matter if the people receiving the ashes believe it's him, and he's not there anymore? Isn't it just in the mind, is in conceptual anyway? And I was just curious if you had any thoughts about that, either of you.
Well, let's say you were at the hospital giving birth to a baby. And, you know, they keep 8 or 10 of them in the same room together. And as long as you believe the one they give you is yours. So it is interesting that this relationship we have with ashes, you know, is sort of changing as we become more accustomed. Because people will say to me, how am I going to know that's really mom? And I say, well, the only way you can know is to go with me. And so I invite people to go with me to the crematory. And I've never had anybody say, boy, I wish I didn't do that. They are uniformly grateful for having, for exactly the same reason why David is so much more engaged at the end than he was at his father's funeral. Because he's really in it. He's really there, and he's really really part of it. And, you know, this horror that took place in Noble, Georgia a few years ago where bodies were found littered around a crematory. Well, of course, the operator of the crematory was a criminal or a nut or both. And, of course, the funeral directors who had allowed that, you know, allowed people in their charge to be taken there were negligent. But what about the culture of negligence that doesn't go watch for themselves? So, I mean, I just remember very, very plainly this woman coming to pick up the ashes of her sister. And this will tell you how our views are changing. She picked up her sister's ashes from the funeral home, walked out to the car, clicked the trunk, and thought better of it, closed the trunk, walked around to the back door, opened the door, closed it again, walked to the passenger door, opened it up, put her on the seat, and then buckled the seatbelt around her. And so whether the ashes of the dead are remnant, icon, relic, that's not for us to say. That's for the one who bears them to say.
Well, my question is very much related to the gentleman's last comments. If I could return briefly to Golfatorium, one of the beautiful things about that story is how it literally represents how important it is to keep a face on death. And what I wanted to ask you both about was what you your reaction is to the fact that every day we are confronted with thousands of faceless deaths, tens of thousands, and I'm wondering what impact you think that has, really, on the psyche, international, remote. 86,000 people die or have died in Pakistan. I mean, the numbers are sublime. And what does that do to our minds and our hearts?
I believe that for those of us who live in little insular bubbles where we don't really have to confront death, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to work on the show is to work with characters who did, who got their hands in it, is it doesn't seem real. You know, and I think if it, in a way, there's that, and then there's also the fact that, you know, people getting killed is so much a part of our entertainment. And there's a horrible, horrible statistic that by the time somebody turns 18, they've seen like 40,000 simulated murders on television as part of, you know, just TV and the movies. So I think that, that sort of ties into it doesn't seem real to us, you know. I wish there was a way for it. I mean, hopefully, I was trying to do something to it that did make it seem a little bit more real and did say that, you know, there are consequences. And they're emotional and they're physical. And
so,
when
we watch 6 Feet Under, or, you know, we have a direct experience, I mean, when our heart is literally moved by an experience of death, I mean, in a way, does it allow us to take in, do you think, these faceless deaths anymore? I mean, Thomas, do you feel like
you... I think it does sensitize. I think that there's a difference between the body count on 6 Feet Under and the body count on Law and Order or CSI or the Evening News. And I think because... on 6 Feet Under, the body has to be dealt with. It is the process, okay? What happens in the beginning is going to be dealt with by the end, one way, and a lot of stuff in between. But the thing about all the other sort of faux deaths on TV, and this is, you're absolutely right, as the body count, which has doubled, AP had a story a couple weeks ago, the body count over the past 6 years has doubled in primetime. So as the body count on TV, this, you know, sort of virtual death count rises, the chance of actually seeing a dead body that has importance to you emotionally or politically or any other way is going down. This creates a kind of detachment from the real world. I always said to funeral directors, a lot of people love 6 Feet Under because it's the only time they're going to ever see a corpse. Do you know? It's kind of like that paragraph at the bottom of every obituary in the London death notices, no flowers, please. And then as soon as the princess dies, you know, there's some flowers everywhere because they didn't get to send them to Aunt Tilly, you know. So.
Right.
I have one more question here.
First of all, your show was wonderful, but I want to address myself to a couple things. You both tonight, I came here not wanting to hear about the topic. Someone brought me here and so on. And also, I've just put out my power to Hootacoos to say to pull the plug. And I want you to know that you both have given me an awful lot to think about. And you've read some wonderful images of passing and what goes on. But my question is about one person. The woman whose body lies there, she is brain dead, and the parents and the husband fight about ending it. Do you have any comment on that?
We're talking about Terry Schiavo.
Yes.
I think that is a personal struggle between the parents and the husband, and I don't think the government has any part in it.
Amen. Yeah, I think so too. That's something that should be worked out with their doctors, their rabbis or pastors or priests or shamans, you know.
And it shouldn't be seized upon as a opportunity for political grandstanding, yeah, on either side.
I'd like to ask if it's okay with you, Alan, if we can end this evening, because we've so many thoughts and feelings, and have moved through us with a poem. We have with one of Thomas's poems. Would that be?
Sure, I'll give you one. You know, I used to always write sonnets. You could mail 14 lines for 14 cents. I thought, like, this is the postal service imitating art, but prices went up and I got older and I didn't count as well, so, which explains the title for this, I think, 15-line poem called Refusing at 52 to Write Sonnets. Yeah. I got to tell you, I'm just so glad to meet you. This is like big. This
too.
Is big in my life.
Me
I'm going
to
tell you. This is going to go in my obituary. I'm telling you. It came to him that he could nearly count how many Decembers he had left to him in increments of 10 or, say, 11, thus 63, 74, 85. He couldn't see himself at 96, humanity's advances notwithstanding in health care, self-help, or new age regimens, what with his habits and family history. The end, he thought, is nearer than you think. The future, thus confined to its contingencies, the present moment opens like a gift. The balding month, the gray week, the dull morning, the hour's routine, the minute's passing glance, all seem like godsends now. And what to make of this? At the end, the word that comes to us is thanks. Thanks.
Thank you all.
That was writer-director Alan Ball and writer-undertaker Thomas Lynch. You're listening to Radio Aloud, a library of the airwaves from the Los Angeles Central Library. This week on Radio Aloud, we remember the great American playwright August Wilson, who died this past October 2005. August Wilson chronicled the African-American experience in the 20th century. His plays, the New York Times noted, depicted the struggles of black Americans with uncommon lyrical richness and emotional heft. Mr. Wilson also describes the universal truths about the struggle for dignity, love, and happiness in the face of often overwhelming obstacles. August Wilson received the Los Angeles Public Library Literary Award in 2003. We go back to that moving presentation 2 years ago when he opened with a monologue from his 1987 Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Fences. From the Radio Aloud archive, the late August Wilson.
Look here, Bono. I looked up one day and death was marching straight at me, like soldiers on parade. The army of death marching straight at me. The middle of July, 1941. It's like a real cold, just like it'd be winter. It seemed like death himself reached out and touched me on the shoulder. He touched me just like I touched you. I say, what you want, Mr. Death? You be wanting me? You done brought your army to be getting me? I looked him dead in the eyes. I wasn't fear nothing. See, the Bible say be ever vigilant. See, that's why I don't get so drunk. See, I got to keep watch. You know, Death standing there, grinning at me, can that sickle on his hand. And finally he say, you want bound over for another year? See, just like that. You want bound over for another year? I say, bound over here? Let's settle this now. See, he kind of fell back when I said that. It seemed like all the cold went out of me, and I reached down, grabbed that sickle, and threw it just as far as I can throw it. See, and me and Death commenced the wrestling. We wrestled for 3 days and three nights. I don't know where I got the strength from. Every time it looked like he was going to get the best of me, I reached way deep down inside myself and come up with the strength to do him one better. So, all right. At the end of the third night, we done weakened each other till we can hardly move. Death stood up and throwed on his robe. You know, he had a white robe with a hood on it. See? He throwed on that robe and went off to look for a sickle, and he say, I'll be back. See, just like that, I'll be back. I told him, I said, yeah, but you're going to have to find me. I wasn't no fool. I wasn't going looking for him. And I know that he got to get me. I know I got to join his army, his camp followers. But as long as I keep up my strength to see him coming, as long as I keep up my vigilance, he's going to have to fight to get me. That was Troy Maxson from Fences.
Thank Wilson's play cycles took place in different decades of the 20th century, and mostly in the African-American Hill District of Pittsburgh, where he was born. He eventually settled in St. Paul and then Seattle, but his obituary notes that Wilson's spiritual home remained the rough streets of the Hill District, where, as a young man, he sat enthralled to the voices of African-American working men and women. Years later, he would discern in their stories, their jokes and their squabbles, the raw material for an art that would celebrate the sustaining richness of the Black American experience. For August Wilson, his life as an artist defined his being.
Thank you for your warm welcome. I am pleased to be here. How's everybody in here? When I lived in Pittsburgh, there was a restaurant. It's called Pan Fried Fish. I've never found anybody who knew the name of the restaurant. We called it Pan Fried Fish because they had a neon sign in the window that said Pan Fried Fish. So it's like, meet me down at Pan Fried Fish, you know? Where are you going? I'm going to Pan Fried Fish. And Pan Fried Fish was started from by two ladies from Alabama who came up to Pittsburgh in Alabama in the 40s. And they brought with them two frying pans. And I'm talking about these are the biggest frying pans in the world. And they started that restaurant, they started frying up fish. There was a guy that lived around the corner of Pan Fried Fish. Had a bootleg mechanic named Ace, and he had a little garage around the corner. And Ace would hit the door of Pan Fried Fish, and he'd go, "How's everybody in here?" And I found out that, you know, Ace was not asking how you were doing. Ace was announcing his presence. And I found this out because nobody ever said, "Fine, I'm doing all right," you know. They would say things like, "I'm going to steal that hat." See, that meant you liked the hat, you know. Or like, "Where you get that hat from?" That meant you didn't like it. Right? Or, "Hey, hey, how's everybody in here?" And they say, "Hey, I see your boy down the street got a new car." He said, "Who got a new car?" He said, "Oh, Big Ben went on that restaurant down in Winston." "What'd he get?" He said, "I don't know, Buick, I think, you know." "Why you want to tie me on with him? He ain't none of my boy." Well, he said, I remember when y'all used to be tight. And he said, "Well, it must have been when he had that little yellow gal working for him." See, that's the only time you ever seen me down there. He said, "Whatever happened to that gal?" "Well, she married one of them boys that drive a bus. That's the last I heard." He goes, "She wasn't the one, huh?" He goes, "No, she wasn't the one. I thought she was. See, but then I believe Rosie done put a curse on me. See, she don't want me to have no other woman, but then she didn't want me." I told her, I said, "Baby, just tell me what kind of biscuits you want to make. See, I'm like the mailman. I could grind it up any way you want." So she knew I was telling the truth about that. She couldn't say nothing about that. She said, "You're a poor man." I said, "What I want with a poor man?" I told her, I said, "Baby, if I get 100, I give you 99. See, she didn't trust me on that. But sure enough, I went down to the crap game, hit 6 quick licks, and left out of there with $163. See, I went on back, laid $100 down on the table, and told her, "Said, now, if I can just get one of them back, I'd be satisfied." She reached down, handed me a dollar, and I went on in the room and went to bed. She got up, she had my breakfast on the table. See, it wasn't soon long that $99 run out. And the next thing I know, she had barred the door. See, I went on and left. I said, "I'm going to find me another woman." See, every time I find one, time I lay down with them, I see her face. I told myself, say, the first time I lay down with a woman don't see Rosie's face, see, that'd be the one I'm going to marry. See, that'd be my little test. See, now, with that little yellow gal worked down at Ben's place, so I saw Rosie's face, but it was blurry. I told myself, say, I got to try this again. He said, maybe next time I won't see nothing. And she told me she didn't want to see me no more. You know, she told me, come back tomorrow, same time tomorrow, if she changed her mind, she leave the key in the mailbox. See, I went on up there. There's one fella in the house, two others sitting on doorstep. I don't know who had the key. It was from my play, Jitney.
Playwright August Wilson.
Well, you know, I've been writing since April 1st, 1965. when I marked that day because that's the day that I wrote a paper for my sister who was going to Fordham University on Robert Frost and Carl Sandburg, and she sent me $20, and I went down to McFerrin's typewriter store and spent it all in one place. And I brought the typewriter, and I was living in a little basement apartment, and I put it down on my kitchen table. And I said, now I'm a writer. That meant I wasn't going to be a bus driver. I wasn't going to be a lawyer. I wasn't going to be, you know, I was 20 years old, and this is what I wanted to do. And I did that. And I remember I sat there, and I had some poems, and I typed up the poem, and I looked at places to send them, and some people paid 35 cents a line. Other people paid a dollar. And Harper's was a magazine that paid a dollar, so I typed up this poem, and I was going to send it to this 18-line poem, and I was going to send it to Harper's. And as I was putting the poem in the envelope, I did something that would have made Sister Mary Ildefons proud. I took that poem and broke it down into 36 lines, just in case. Right? The poem came back like the next day, you know. And then I sat down and said, I'm going to have to learn how to write a poem. Oh, I said, I see, this is serious. I'm going to have to learn how to write a poem. And it was 8 years later before I wrote a poem that was in my own voice. So it took me 8 years to find my, and that was the beginning of my success right there. That was my success, you know. I didn't measure it by anything other than for myself in terms of my pursuit of my art. You know, and see that leads me, because it is a pursuit, and that leads me to if I may just tell you a brief story about a friend of mine who, when he met John Coltrane, it was shortly before he died in 1967, and at that time, John Coltrane was considered, you know, the most innovative saxophone player in the history of jazz, and my friend Carl Jennings plays saxophone, and a friend of theirs, you know, said, I was going to introduce him. So he goes, John. He said, this is Carl, you know. Carl plays saxophone. And John Coltrane looked at him and said, you play saxophone? He said, yeah. He said, teach me something. And he looked at him, and he goes, yeah, you know, like, what you working on? And he said, well, I'm working on my scales. And he said, that's good. You keep working on your scales. And he went on to find somebody else, you see, because he was on a search. Right? And as an artist, you know, you're always on that search. So I measure my success by in terms of how successful I am on the search that I'm on. So what keeps me inspired is that search. And then that leads me to this other story, and then I think I'm going to shut up. When I was in 1968, we were rehearsing a play in a grade school auditorium in which there was a piano in the auditorium. And so one day this guy walked in. He was a small guy, and he just sort of stood there, and then he goes, could I play the piano? And we looked at him and said, you play? Yeah, man, go ahead. I mean, if you play, you know, we don't know nothing about that piano. And this man went over and began to play the piano, and he began to make world-class piano, jazz piano. We're talking about Art Tatum. I mean, this guy's playing his piano like none of us had ever heard. And all of a sudden, he jumps up, and he hits the piano with his hand. He goes, let me tell you this, man. He bangs his head on the piano, busts his head open, and he begins to kick very seriously. And he went doing this gingerly, kick and beat up this piano all the time, screaming, let me tell you this, man. Let me tell you this, man. Let me tell you this, man. Let me tell you, man. And we go, man, what the? And we grabbed him. And we got him down, and he's like, limitation. We said, man, what is he saying? And he's saying, limitation of the instrument. Limitation of the instrument. So I thought, oh, I see. He heard something in his head he couldn't play. You know, and I carried that interpretation of it all those many years. And then I realized, no, that's not it. He had reached the point of the limitation of the instrument. He reached where John Coltrane was trying to go. John Coltrane never got there. And in order to understand that, all you got to do is imagine Pablo Picasso standing in front of a canvas with a paintbrush in his hand and going, limitation of the instrument. Like, I did it all with this. I can't give expression through this medium anymore. Let me go over here and, you know, do some sculpture or do something else. But this is limited. You know, and as an artist, that's where you want to go. And as an artist, that's where I want to go, man. So if you ever hear me say, well, you know, August Wilson quit then you know I reached the limitation of the instrument. And after that, ain't nothing else to do. Thank you.
That was the late Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright August Wilson speaking at the Central Library in Los Angeles as recipient of the 2003 Los Angeles Public Library Literary Award. On our final segment of Radio Aloud, poet W.S. Merwin reminds us of the immense beauty of words. W.S. Merwin is one of the most widely read poets in America. His career spans over 5 decades. He began writing hymns at the age of 5 for his father, a Presbyterian minister. An environmental activist, Merwin's collection Migration, selected poems from 1951 to 2001, won the 2005 National Book Award for Poetry. This is from the citation for the National Book Award. The poems in W.S. Merwin's Migration speak from a lifelong belief in the power of words to awaken our drowsy souls and see the world with compassionate interconnection. Poet W.S. Merwin.
I think of poetry, by the way, as primarily unwritten. Because I think of language beginning in the first place to express something that had never been expressed, that could not be expressed. And there are linguists, and I join them in their belief, who believe that probably the primordial thing that demanded expression was grief. If you've ever heard primal grief, you know that it comes out as one long vowel, and then something has to be done to give that vowel form, and it would be the beginning of consonants and the beginning of language. And as language happens, it's owned socially, and it's the beginning of being able to draw someone back from the really destructive urge and force and motion, a motive of grief, to something that can be shared, and it can perhaps lead them back into life again. So one of the things about real grief is you don't want life. You don't want to be in the life that you shared with the lost. The unwritten. Well, no, I didn't finish what I was saying. Because I think of poetry as being and about something that can be known and about information and things like that. And those things may exist in poetry, but they're not why poetry exists. Poetry exists to say what words can't say. And one turns to poetry for those things, and one returns to them and tries to make it and tries to repeat it and goes back and back and back to it for those same reasons. It's not for what can be conveyed, but for what can't be conveyed in words. So I think of it as primarily and in the beginning unwritten. Inside this pencil crouch words that have never been written, never been spoken, never been taught. They're hiding. They're awake in there, dark in the dark, hearing us. But they won't come out, not for love, not for time, not for fire. Even when the dark has worn away, they'll still be there, hiding in the air. Multitudes in days to come may walk through them, breathe them, be none the wiser. What script can it be that they won't unroll? In what language? Would I recognize it? Would I be able to follow it, to make out the real names of everything? Maybe there aren't many. It could be that there's only one word, and it's all we need. It's here, in this pencil. Every pencil in the world is like this. Thank you.
That was W.S. Merwin, reading from his work at the Aloud at Central Library Speakers Series. You can find out more about Aloud at Central Library by going to www.aloudla.org. Thank you for joining us on Radio Aloud, a library of the airwaves. I'm Alfred Molina.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET.